happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor and founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. We are celebrating our 15th year of publishing right now. Believe it or not, I thought I would be in Chicago with a few hundred of our readers this week, enjoying the third Fretboard Summit. But alas, 2020 is turning out to not be the year to be celebrating much of anything. But the show must go on. We still got podcasts, we still have videos, and we still have the magazine. And if you have not subscribed to the Fretboard Journal magazine, I would encourage you to do so right now. Go to fretboardjournal.com, click on the shop tab. We have both the keepsake print edition as well as the digital edition. If you use the coupon code podcast when you check out, I will take $5 off of your order. Each issue of our magazine is filled with over 100 pages of profiles and histories about the world of guitars, the luthiers that are out there, our favorite players, and a lot of surprises. It's kind of the guitar magazine for people who thought they hated guitar magazines. And best of all, as with everything we do, it's reader supported, which means there are barely any ads in every issue. We want the content to be king. So go to fretboardjournal.com. Please join us if you haven't yet. It helps support not only the magazine, but also the podcasts and everything else that we do. So if you've listened to this podcast more than once, you know I love guitar history, especially guitar history that has not been covered to death. There are plenty of stories out there that have been rewritten many times over the years about the same five topics. This is not one of those topics. We are talking this week to guitar maker Sherwood Woody Pfeiffer. Woody is unique on a lot of fronts. He is an innovative archtop and electric guitar maker. He describes some of his designs, and they are going to blow you away during this conversation. He has had some pretty heavy-duty clients over the years, including Ronnie Jordan and George Benson. I personally wanted to hear Woody talk about his time at Charles LeBue's The Guitar Lab in the early 70s. This is an era and a place that thoroughly fascinates me. The Guitar Lab was in New York and was sort of the alembic of the East Coast. It was a workshop where interesting offbeat guitars and basses were made and designed, as well as repair work done for all sorts of amazing musicians. And Woody was there on the front lines, along with a couple of other big names that are probably familiar to you if you're listening to this show. Larry DiMarzio was working there, as was Ralph Novak. Last but not least, as if that wasn't enough credentials to get on the podcast, Woody is unique in that he is black. There are just not that many black luthiers in our world. And we talk about that on this show and how Woody ended up becoming a guitar maker. It's an interesting path, and his thoughts on why there aren't more. And so I hope you enjoy this chat. I think we'll be talking to Woody again sometime in the near future, because I know we have not exhausted all the stories and all the thoughts that he has. As always, I welcome your feedback. You can send us a note at podcast@fretboardjournal.com if you want to. This podcast is sponsored, as it is always, by a couple of brands that are close to my heart. First up is Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags and studio monitor stands and backpacks and pedal boards and pedal board cases. Everything they do is basically indestructible and so well designed. I love all of their products. I rock the Mono Vertigo case for my Telecaster, and everyone I know who I see with a Mono product loves what they have. Our other sponsor is our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars, also back east in New York. We're talking archtops with Woody a little bit today, so I decided to see what new arrivals they had that were in the archtop category. Right now, they have a 1948 Gibson L4 that just came in. That's the 16-inch body, one of only 125 made that year. And then if you need something a little wider, maybe a little more up to date. They have a 1951 Gibson ES5. That is the Gibson ES5, which has the not one, not two, but three P90s on it. A beautiful 17-inch arch top. Check that out and everything else that they have over at retrofret.com. Again, today's podcast is with Woody Pfeiffer, who has led a fascinating life and has so many interesting ideas about guitars. I think you're going to love it. Thank you in advance for tuning in to the podcast. Keep the reviews coming on Apple Podcasts, and don't forget to tune into the other podcasts that we put out, including The Truth About Vintage Amps and Luthier on Luthier. Fretboard Journal's 46th issue is going to be mailing out around the 1st of August, and I do hope that you will check it out. All right, here is my chat with Woody Pfeiffer. I hope you love it.
How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good.
So where in New York are you?
I'm in the Catskills. I'm about 15 miles west of I'm in the town called Phoenicia.
Okay. How long have you been up there?
I've been here about 10 years now.
Okay.
Prior to that, I was down in Garnerville, New York, which is by Nyack, in the area of the Tappan Zee Bridge. I was down there for about 16 years.
Well, let's just get started and get your whole life story. How's that?
Okay, we'll get another version of it. I've got pieces, bits and pieces online and my website and a couple of other places where there's information about my life from early on till now.
But yeah.
You can start asking questions wherever you'd like to start asking questions.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Woody. I've known about you for a while. I've seen some of your exquisite arch tops online. I have not seen any up close. I don't think our paths ever cross at the, I'm usually at the West Coast guitar festivals. You're usually at the East Coast ones when those take place. I guess before we get your whole life story, how are you doing right now with the pandemic and how has it affected your guitar building?
Well, it's challenging. I mean, it's pretty much business as usual for me. I spend all of my time in my shop, so I'm not missing that. I'm just missing the visitation from different players, missing the jam sessions and the gigs that I go to. I generally try to once a month. I'm pilgrimage to the city. I take an instrument or two with me, see who's playing, and I try to make one or two gigs within one evening and be able to sit in the audience and hear what an instrument does in a live situation and get some real feedback from, you know, musicians that are out there. That's very helpful in fine-tuning things and figuring out what's really going on.
I know there's some, like, well-known, super well-known players who've owned your instruments. Are there a couple in the city that you go to regularly for that kind of feedback?
Well, recently I've had the pleasure of sitting in the audience listening to Ed Cherry, who was formerly Dizzy Gillespie's guitarist.
Wow.
And I've had Jimmy Bruno play my instruments, and Bobby Broom, and David Gilmore, who I think I send you pictures. I'm building a semi-hollow body version of my 16-inch arch top now. And that's pretty much the guys of name. And there's a whole lot of other guys who are not well-known, but really just a plethora of really killer players out here. That some of these young guys is fresh out of school. One of those would be Gabe Schneider.
Okay.
Who's currently playing guitar with Wynton Marsalis's group. And so I've been working with him, and Matt Fink, who's another killer jazz guitarist, bebop guy, who's actually an instructor here at up in Albany at Music College. And Richie Hart, who's also a protege of George Benson's. He's a jazz guitarist as well, and he owns one of my arch tops. And so these guys have been helpful in showing up at most of these shows to demo my instruments, because a lot of the shows have a demonstration period, either an hour or, 45 minutes, where they're on stage and they're able to, get the most out of the instrument and present that to an audience. So that's been also helpful for me as a builder to hear what they have to say and give me feedback, and you can keep tweaking the idea of what it is that's behind my instruments and get the most out of it, where it's actually a useful tool, which is what these are supposed to be. They're not eye candy to hang on the wall. They're supposed to be the things that you actually would hand an instrument to a player, and the biggest compliment I can get is from somebody who would tell me that they're playing something that they've never played before, because the instrument has brought that out of them. Just in terms of facilitating, you know, the access of tonality and playability, and it's just, that just speaks volumes of that I've done something really good.
Yeah, I can only imagine. You've been at this a long time. You had a brief chapter at a place called the Guitar Lab, which I'm fascinated by. I want to hear all about that. But when did this woodworking bug, when did the guitar making thing really hit you?
We have to go backwards a minute. As a child, I made just about everything that fascinated me in terms of toys. And a lot of woodworking things came about when I got fascinated with flying airplanes. My father was a Tuskegee Airman, and so I had a fascination with airplanes, and he would take us to the airport and see things and take us to RC fields when it was in its infancy and people would lose planes. But I would be able to sit there and look at all these airplanes and kits and gliders, and I would go home and I would just get balsa wood and start making a plane, design it, and, you know, and from that point, it's just anything that kind of fascinated me, I would just figure out, what do I need to know to actually do that? So when I began to play music, it was the same thing. I looked at what was happening outside, what was the popular instrument, and I borrowed a friend of mine's Telecaster and took it apart. He didn't know that. So, I took it apart and I made templates and patterns, and then I went about making a Telecaster. But before
this was like
I
in high school?
I'm already. Right out of high school. Now, more or less, that was probably when I came home from college.
Okay.
When I was in high school, I was involved with other things. I was running track, and I actually made a set of indoor track shoes from a pair of outdoor spiked performance shoes or Adidas. I made a set of indoor flats that Adidas did not even have. I did that when I was a freshman in high school, and I had everybody on my team that wore size 10 borrowing my shoes for the finals. But, you know, that's kind of like what I'm saying about it. It's something that I gravitated towards. I would figure out what I needed to do that, you know, and immediately what would happen is I would look at something and I would be redesigning it as I was looking at it. Okay, there's a better way to do that. And what's the better way? And I'd go about doing it. And that's how I approached the guitars. Like I said, I borrowed a Telecaster, but in the midst of me trying to copy it, I started morphing things from a Strat, body contours and things like that. And suddenly it wasn't a Telecaster when I finished making this first instrument. And that was the instrument that actually got me hired at Guitar Lab, because I had not worked with that type of equipment. I'd never used a router. And here I was, I had to put a pickup in. So I went to 48th Street, not knowing, never being to 48th Street. I got on the train. I got on the wrong end of the train, but not the wrong end of the train. I walked down 47th Street, and I saw a shingle sitting out from a building, and it said Guitar Lab on it. It was the only reference to guitar that I saw at that time, and where everyone told me, oh, you can't miss all the stores. Yeah, I wasn't on 48th Street. I was on 47th. So I went into to Guitar Lab and asked the question, how do you route or cut this hole for the pickup? And I got an explanation, and then I went home, and I found somebody that had a shop, and they let me use a router, and I put the pickup in. And then the next time I visited the shop, it was during the summer. I was home for summer break, and I was in college taking math and electronics, and I got hired to do the electronics on my second visit to Guitar Lab, and it just progressed from there.
This is like 1970, 71?
That was 70.
Wow.
And at the time, Larry DiMarzio worked at Guitar Lab. Steve Blucher was working at Guitar Lab, and Larry DiMarzio was actually the first person that showed me how to do a fret job. And, you know, he was in the midst of doing all his pickup work and copying what Gibson had done and using Gibson coils. And, you know, it was at his infancy. And the other person that was there also in electronics was worked for Hawk Electronics, and that was Steve Kaufman. So another important guy.
Yeah, I'll say. And that main guy there, I guess the owner is Charles LeBeau.
Charlie?
Yeah.
Charlie was he was my mentor, show me the way instruments were being made and how he was going about doing it. And when he saw what I was trying to do on my own, that's what, like I said, he saw it. He said, "Hey, you need a job?" And I said, "Absolutely." And for me, it was just along the same path I had already been traveling in terms of creating things and just absorbing information. And here you are in college taking math and electronics. When it was time to go back to school, I had a choice to make. Do I stay as an apprentice or do I go back to college? And it just resonated with me to stay here, keep learning this trade. And, you know, everybody said, you need to go to finish your school. You need to get a real job. This is the real job.
Was Guitar Lab, I mean, it's often likened to like the East Coast Alembic. You guys definitely were making instruments, but I'm guessing you had a steady stream of repair too. Were there just like rock stars coming in all the time, or what was the vibe like?
The vibe was intense. We had everybody and anybody you could think of at Guitar Lab, and the only other place that was around at the time making anything was Carl Thompson. And Charlie and Carl had been partners in a business that when they separated, Carl went off doing just basses and Charlie went off doing guitars. That was the only two builders in New York that I knew of at the time. And we basically were doing a lot of the repair work for just about everybody that was doing things. And we were on 47th Street, and that, I think we moved down to the Village in 1973 or 4. At the time, we were building instruments for Kiss and working closely with Rick Derringer and Johnny Winters and, my God, and the list is, it's a long list of people that we worked with doing repair work, restoration, and building instruments for.
And were responsibilities kind of divided up equally, or did you specialize in one thing versus what the other guys did?
Well, initially when I started working at Guitar Lab, like I said, Larry DiMaggio showed me the ropes of doing a fret job. Uh-huh. And somewhere around the second or third fret job I did, he realized, okay, I'm not doing fret jobs anymore. This is the guy. And so I became the guy doing all the fret work.
Sounds painful.
And I just assumed the responsibilities for a lot of the intricate jobs, like broken headstocks, things like that. That, you know, I'd be doing a job on something, and Charlie would come behind me and say, "Oh, that's right, but you're not going to get that joint any closer." And I said, "Give me a minute." And he'd come back, and I would take 20 more minutes and get it so that it was invisible. And he would say, "How the hell did you do that?" It's like, patience. And that just was the trend of things. So by the time we were in the Village, I was basically doing everything. Steve Blucher was doing a lot of the electronic wiring, but anything that had to do with woodworking, repair, stuff like that, of that nature, I was handling all of that, and I was opening and closing the shop. The one thing I didn't do was any finishing, so Charlie maintained control over the spray gun.
Okay.
Let me get any kind of information to do that. And that's the way that went. At that time, is when he made a bass for Alfonso Johnson and a couple of other cats at the time, Rick Derringer's instrument. And I happened to get to be able to do repair work for Todd Runyon on one of his double necks, and worked on John McLaughlin's instrument. And I would have to pull a list out of people.
It's okay. Everybody went there.
That worked for them, but everybody went there is right. And there weren't a lot of shops at the time, not like to what today, where there's so many shops and so many builders. I was in the very beginning.
Is that where were you able to do any of your first instrument designs there, or were you mainly just focused on the repair?
No, we did. We were building instruments. Charlie was building instruments from when we were at 47th Street. And I was more of an observer of what was happening then. I didn't participate, although I made my own things on my own. But I took a lot of the information necessary there. But when we went to the Village, at that point I had gotten to a place where I was carving and And so the first series of electric instruments that came out of Guitar Lab with a carved top were instruments that I actually carved a prototype. And we sent those prototypes over to Jersey to a firm there, and they were actually copying my work and sending us back finished carved bodies that we would clean up and do the rest of the work on. Okay. And that was the first real line of instruments that we were making out of Guitar Lab that were consistently the same. And Charlie still maintained his input with making the basses and just left it like that. He did basses. And we had another gentleman there that was working named Bruce Hoheb, who designed a bass instrument. He was working with us for a while in Thompson Street. But eventually, the shop got very busy, and the clientele was just overwhelming. And Charlie and I kind of deviated away from what he felt was the way we should go direction in terms of carving a top and a back. Their idea of how it was supposed to go. That's pretty much when we separated, and I went my way, and he continued with Guitar Lab, and Guitar Lab left New York and went to California. And I maintained my shop in the Bronx, and then I went back to 48th Street, and that's where I was for till 1983.
So when you leave Guitar Lab, you're just a solo luthier trying to do your own thing?
Well, I leave Guitar Lab, and I had left after developing my version of what the electric guitar was supposed to be, which was a completely carved back and front. And I actually took the prototype of that out to California, and I worked in two different locations. I actually had a repair shop that I started. I worked with Fortune Music, Dale Fortune, in California for a while, and I also had the privilege of working with Danny Armstrong for a minute. But then I was there for about a year, and things didn't quite pan out, and then an opportunity came for me to actually grab a shop right on 48th Street. And so I came back to New York, and I did that. And at that point, I was making my instrument, but it was a bolt-on series. I was making custom necks with bodies that were like basically like Tele or Strat bodies. I did a series of instruments for Larry DiMaggio because he had components. He was making necks and bodies. I did some assembly stuff for him. And I was just overwhelmed with repair work, and I was doing a lot of playing then. I was playing in a band. I was working like seven nights straight. You know, three nights one place, four nights another place. Busy getting my chops together, which also helps in knowing what you're trying to extract out of an instrument in terms of getting a feel and, you know, devoting a lot of time to your playing skills so that you can actually discern whether something is doing what it's supposed to do and it sounds and feels the right way. It's very difficult if you haven't spent that kind of, developed that kind of affinity for the instrument to actually expect to be able to make something that has all of that if you don't even demand it yourself. So it was very important in a sense for me to feel like I was on my way to becoming a killer guitar player as well as a good builder.
Yeah.
Those two things go hand in hand. And pretty much everybody I know that makes a great instrument is a pretty good player.
Yeah. It's always surprising. There's always a few guys who've made a big name for themselves and can't really play. But what style of music were you playing or do you play?
I'm more or less, I play straight ahead kind of jazz stuff.
Yeah.
My chops tend, George Benson is one of my big idols and people of that ilk, playing that type of stuff. Of course, my first initial idol was Jimi Hendrix, and that was kind of where I got involved with the music while I was at college listening to Jimmy, and I said, wow, I want to sound like that.
Yeah, of course. So you're talking about how busy you were. 48th Street, famous music block, music stores everywhere, seems like a great place to sell instruments. Seems like maybe a lousy place to have to buckle down and focus and work on instruments because the door would be opening all the time. Was that the case?
Well, I was not on the ground floor. I was in a building that was actually a building that had multiple recording studios in it. I was actually, the entrance to my building was on Broadway. Not Broadway, that's 7th Avenue. So I was on 7th Avenue on the 12th floor.
Okay.
And so I was above Counterpoint Recording Studio, And I didn't have any interruptions other than someone coming to me directly from a store or by phone appointment. So it was pretty cool. I was able to just focus on what I had to do. And I had the amount of repair work was ridiculous. It didn't leave me a lot of time to say I'm going to build guitars. Between the repair work and an occasional thing that I would be building, and I was working in a band. So I would leave the shop and head for the gig, you know, finish the gig, get home, go to sleep, get back to the shop. So it was that kind of cycle.
You're like a monk.
Yeah, it was a little crazy. Very crazy period of time where it just was a lot going on. But I was in touch with a lot of different musicians, did a lot of work for so many different people. I had the opportunity to do fret jobs for Geddy Lee when they were in town, and go to the garden, and I did work for Bob Marley's group 10 years after. It's just Foreigner. It's a lot of groups. Work with Will Lee and a bunch of studio musicians who were in the same building that my shop was in. All these floors were all day long were going with recording sessions, so I got an opportunity to see a lot of recording artists that were in doing jingles and commercials, and all the actual various recording studios knew that if there was any issues with intonation, go see Woody's right upstairs. So we get people dropping in on me in the middle of the session. He can't get in tune. What's the problem? Okay. Done. You know. So.
You're the guy who's got to repair something in 5 minutes.
I just had that recently happen a couple of years ago now, 2 years ago. Cal David, jet blues player.
Yeah.
He came to do the gig and opened his case, and his instrument was destroyed by the airlines. And so I wound up doing a repair for him. That was a lengthy repair. He left his 63 reverse Firebird with me, and he ran around and he found another one because that's his sound. So he found another Firebird that he picked up somewhere up in Connecticut, and he brought that to me literally 10 hours before the gig. And it was unplayable, but he needed it. So I refretted it before the gig.
Wow.
So he made the gig. Oddly enough, the next year, the same gig, he comes back and the same thing happens. Airlines destroyed that instrument again. But I've done a lot of those kind of jobs at this point where people say, it can't be fixed, it's done. And I usually get the call. Everyone says it can't be fixed. What can you do? And I have to pull the rabbit out of the hat. So it's somewhat of a challenge, but it just challenges all your skill set that you've acquired. And it's always amazing, and it's always something different. You know, no two repair jobs are the same. So I tell people all the time, it's not a repair work. It's a restoration that I do. Repairs are things that you can obviously see. A restoration, no one knows you were there. That's approach it.
Yeah. And you, in terms of your own builds, you mentioned that carved back, carved top guitar. What guitars, and maybe back then and today, really speak to you? What style of guitars, what other makers really resonate with you more than any others?
I want to say none at this point.
All right, well, let's go back then.
Back then, I was enamored with a Strat.
Yep.
I didn't particularly like a Tele, but it was the first electric instrument that I had come in contact with that I actually had the opportunity to sit down and play with. And as soon as I got a Strat in my hand, I said, "No, this is the instrument for me." But what I designed was based around all of the instruments I've had opportunity to work on, because you don't want to make something that's so new that you put it in a player's hands and it feels foreign to them. They've got to adjust their playing style in order to play it. That's not what you want to do. I'm trying to incorporate things that have found that are the best of attributes of all those things and put them together into one package. And that's what I feel I've done in terms of the instrument's balance, in terms of how it feels when you sit with it. How does it feel when you have a strap on it? How does it feel an hour later when you're on stage? That's a very important factor. And so I designed around those type of, you know, criteria that's important for the player. And what I built today is an embodiment of all of those different things that I've found in the best of the instruments out there, and along with the information that I get from the players, you know, what people tell you are the pros and cons, and you can pretty much put together a kind of a concise of what works and what doesn't work, and what they're accustomed to and have to deal with, but they deal with it. You know, it's certain things. It's like someone drew an analogy for me, and that is like we all wear shoes. You go to the shoe store, you say wear size 10, but the first time you go to the shoemaker, he tells you, hey, you wear actually a size 10 and a quarter and a 9 3/4. That's, your feet are not the same. And the first time you wear the custom shoes, and you realize, wow, what have I been wearing all these years? That's how I want this to, you know, go, in terms of having an instrument that has everything in it that you could possibly want in an instrument, and none of the bad things, you know. Balance of it, where you sit, everything is accessible. Comping chords is accessible. Getting to the upper register is accessible. Standing up, all of those things are the same. Nothing goes away from you. You're not on stage wrestling and fighting to try to find the right place to place the instrument so that you can get everywhere you have to get to. And it took a little bit of a challenge, because, you know, that's, you're actually breaking the mold, and you're going outside, you know, you're outside box that most people are willing to do. Everybody wants to follow a formula that's tried and true and accepted by the majority. And for me, it's like, no, that's the same size shoe that everybody keeps wearing. I said, no, there's another way to go about this. Let me figure out to leave out what I need to add on, and where do I go from there? And then something actually a little better than that. My instrument will balance on your leg without you touching it. You can just sit it on your knee or across your thigh and let it go. It doesn't take a nosedive. It doesn't take a tail dive. And that same thing holds true when you put the strap on and you're standing up. Because most instruments, you're wrestling with them. Les Paul is a little tail heavy. Some other instruments are headstock heavy. Whatever is not going to work in terms of the balance, or if you've got a sharp portion to the back of the instrument that's going to engage your rib cage, you may get away with it one night. By the second night, third night, that's going to be a hot spot, and you're going to realize, wow, this thing is digging into me. So I had to take all of that in consideration, the ergonomics of the instrument and how it's shaped and where it meets the body. You know, people look at the face value of what the instrument looks like on the front side, but what's in contact with the player all night long is the back of the guitar, and it's really important.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I agree with everything you just said. What, how, when did you eventually leave the city?
Well, when I left Guitar Lab, that's when I left the city. Pretty much, I went up to the Bronx and I had my own shop there for a time. And then I made a trip back to 48th Street, and I was on 48th Street for a little while. Then I went to, after that, I went to California for a while, a year I was there. When I came back, again, I was in a shop in the city, and somewhere in, actually, it wasn't until 1993 that I said, well, it was actually before that, 86, I came up here to Phoenicia, and I was up here in Phoenicia for about 3 years, and from here, I went down to the city again, to the Bronx, and worked out of my apartment for a while, just doing a lot of design work. I took a little time off to try to fund myself. I designed a motorcycle lock, which I got a U.S. and international patent on.
A motorcycle
and that
what?
Took a lock for a motorcycle.
Oh, wow.
I was
okay.
Big into motorcycles, so I made a lock called a Rotor Locket, and I have a U.S. and international patent on that. Again, the same mindset that we were talking about earlier, whereas if it's something that I'm doing and there's something about it that I need, then I'm going to go and try to design that something, whatever that is. And in this particular case, it was a security system. I had had several bikes stolen in the city, and I said, it's got to be a better way to go about this. So I designed a motorcycle lock that captures the front brake rotor. It also has an orifice in the lock that allows you to put a cable from that to lock onto something. And I pursued that and did a whole write-up and did my own patent work up on it, and then literally went to a patent company and went from there, and I actually got the U.S. patent and the EPO, European patent on it. And I thought that was going to be a huge thing, and it didn't go that way. And so I said, okay, let me get back to work with the guitars. at that point, I went to Garnerville and got a nice big factory space and actually went full time into designing and building instruments. And I was still doing repair work and restoration work, but the primary goal at that point was to make my own product line with my name on the headstock. Enough of working on Gibson, Fender, and Gretsch and Guild. And, yeah. Although I still see those names now.
Of course. They're going to haunt you till the end of time.
That's it.
I'm just so floored by everything you just said. So leaving the city was really your opportunity to start to build your own stuff a little bit more, some breathing room.
Breathing room, a lower overhead cost. When you're in the city, I mean, the cost of doing business and renting a place is just so it's just out of this world. I mean, astronomical figures for monthly rent leaves you just busting your butt just to try to pay the bills. You don't have room to sit down and casually design anything, go about a design pattern and prototyping and a time period where you're not pulling in any money, but you're just doing experimentation. That doesn't exist and under those circumstances. So I didn't really have the time to develop anything while I was in the city. When I got to Garnerville, that afforded me a different kind of a look in terms of time and space to be able to sit down and say, okay, I'll design an instrument now based on a prototype that I had initially put together in 1984. And I did work at Mandolin Brothers for 2 years. And during that 2 year period, working with Stanley J, I went to him with prototype, bass and guitar, met Hap Kaufman and thought, hey, maybe this is a possibility to find some funding to get behind my design work. But that didn't happen. Spent 2 years there, and when I realized it wasn't going to happen, I said, it's time for me to go back and do my own thing again. So eventually you get to a place where you realize, okay, there's nobody coming to the rescue on a financial tip to make an investment, to actually take these designs to a bigger production level. So I just said, instead of trying to make an instrument that would be market penetration instrument on the low side of things, I just continue to grow in terms of skill and design work and figure I'll make the finest instrument that I can make at this point.
Yeah.
Beat the drum from the other side of the table, so I can make something that actually catches attention. And then if it gets to a point of production on a bigger scale, then you scale back to go into production. Or leave off some details and some finer points. Take some of the bells and whistles away. You could all do that, but it's very difficult to put those things there if they don't exist. So,
what was that first prototype? What was that prototype like that you took to Stan? Is it a guitar that you're still making?
Is the guitar that I'm presently making. The body shape has just changed in terms of how much area is behind the bridge and tailpiece, the width of the waist area on the instrument, and then other little changes. The bridge and the tailpiece have gone to a little bit of it's a little more simplistic than it was initially. My initial prototype had a tailpiece with individual string attachments for the tailpiece itself, so you could raise or lower each string and change the actual tension per string. I realized in a production sense that was a little bit overdone, and so I've gone away from that, designed a tailpiece that is all in one, so the entire unit takes that if I want to raise or lower the tailpiece. The bridge is something that's totally apart from anything else that's in the industry right now. Everything right now operates off the principle, which is centuries old. You got a bridge on a spinner that raises the entire assembly up and down, bass and treble side, two independent spinners with a post. I don't have that system. I have a one. The bridge itself is made of ebony. It can be made of rosewood. I've made them out of rosewood and maple, which adds a tonal aspect to the bridge. But the assembly itself is three parts, and it's worked on an actual inclined plane system. So the bridge is a self-contained unit that sits into a pocket on the instrument, and the bridge itself expands in terms of height. And you have independent left and right, treble and bass side, raising or lowering the action. And the saddles are locked into this assembly. So there's no moving parts. So I'm trying to eliminate the moving part aspect of the bridge, which is a loss of vibration and tone. and the only actual moving surface is where the bridge sits in the pocket. And that's the same for all of these bridges, just sitting on the spinner. But then, you know, it's sitting on this actual spinner itself, so you have the surface between the face of the spinner and the underside of the bridge, like on a tunematic. Sure. Then you have the threading system that's threaded posts, and then you have all the saddles, and they're just an arrangement of saddles. Some are held in with spring wire, some are not, but they are loose. You can literally physically move them with your finger if you lift the string up off the saddle itself. It's not locked in place. My assembly is completely locked down. The actual height adjustment and the intonation adjustments are all locked. So the only thing that's moving is where the feet of the bridge is sitting. And like I said, they're sitting in a design designated pocket in the instrument, and a majority of the bridge is below the surface, so you don't see it. So that's part of the concept of when I designed the instrument, was to just actually minimize the amount of hardware that you see above the surface on the face of the instrument. I kind of really don't like the look of hardware heaped up on top of a beautiful instrument. You make a beautiful instrument, now you put the Brooklyn Bridge on top of it. You know, in terms of hardware. Yeah, it's hardware. Do I need to see all this hardware? All I need to see is the essential emergence of a bridge and tailpiece through the face of the instrument at a height that is comparable to what's needed to achieve the right action. That's all I want to see. So I'm minimizing what you're looking at and just try to make everything as tidy as possible. I don't like screws. The only screws that are visibly there on the face of the instrument are the four screws that are in each corner of the mounting ring. Other than that, my back plate only has one screw, and it's not a screw. It's a machine threaded hex screw itself, but it's not screwed in itself. It's a cam system that locks the back plate to the instrument, and when you take the back plate off, it's only one of those. You pull off the back plate, and that screw assembly is part of the back plate, so it's nothing to lose. It's all a complete unit. Same with the truss rod cover. That screw in the truss rod is part of the truss rod cover. So when you take the cover off, it's all one unit. No screw to be lost. And it's a lot of little attention to detail things that I'd like to do. And when you're making something that's supposed to be at the top of the food chain, it should have all of those things. Every aspect of the instrument, to me, should be a trinket. Should be a piece of something that you look at and say, oh my God, I didn't realize that. It takes an hour to make a knob for my electric guitars because it's a combination of using the material that the instrument is designed and made with. If the back of the instrument is mahogany, the base of the knob will be mahogany. If the top is flame maple, the top crown of the knob is maple. If the instrument's bound with black-white binding, there's a separator between those two. The top and the skirt of the knob is the same reflection of the binding that the instrument has. It's white-black between it. And it's all colored the same as the instrument. If this is a sunburst, the top of the knob, sunburst. And it takes an hour, and people tell me, you get a life, you know. But, hey, when you're asking a lot of money for something, I feel there should be a lot of work involved with every aspect of it. I don't want to buy a plastic knob and throw it on an instrument and say, hey, it's 20 grand. It's got plastic knobs and plastic back plates on it and a ton of screws. Give me a break. That's not what you see when you get a Bentley, you know, or a Countach. You get the most that the designer can offer at that point.
What's going on underneath the wood on that, the studio and the solo series? Are those chambered?
Yeah, they're chambered. The instruments are chambered underneath the top, and it removes a pound of what the actual given weight would be from whatever material it is. If the back of the instrument is curly maple, it's the three chambers are either filled with a wood called catalpa, or is spruce, or it's cedar, and all of which are tone woods, and remove a tremendous amount of weight from that if it were a solid maple. It takes away that weight, and it also imbues that instrument with the tonal qualities of those woods.
Wow.
And so the instrument as a solid instrument has a great deal of acoustic, you know, quality about it. And anything that you plug in is just going to amplify what the instrument does dry. So make the instrument sing unplugged. It will sing when you plug it in.
And how many guitars are you building a year these days?
Right now, I'm in the process of building like 4 instruments right now.
Okay.
Everything I'm building are arch tops right now, and I'm doing this brand new instrument. But I'm also doing a few other things that are on my plate on a personal level. I'm doing some home care for my mom, who's 98 years old
now.
It's kind of absorbing a lot of my daily time.
Sure.
But the COVID is just making her health care workers have been ill and say, okay, that just makes it a home thing. So that's pretty much what's going on with me here. So my building is slowed down, and how that has affected me has given me a lot of time to design work that I didn't have time to do before. So hence the new instrument. The instrument I'm building for David is, like I said, a 16-inch archtop model that's being made into a semi-hollow. But there's a departure here. It will not be like a 335 where you have one given sound from the semi-hollow body. This instrument will have an internal structure that can change. I won't go into how that happens,
okay.
But it will sound like a semi-hollow where you need to go through your pedal board and play at that volume. And then there'll be a rotary type of cam on the backside that you will rotate, and this instrument will suddenly have a very big acoustic value. Not the same as an archtop, but it will have a value acoustically that you can literally say, okay, I'm going to have 2 instruments in one.
Wow.
And I have not seen anything like what I'm doing right now out there. And that's I'm kind of geeked about what I'm doing. And when it comes out, it's going to be, it'll be very different. And it'll offer all of the guys who carry multiple instruments to a gig, you'll be able to think about carrying one instrument and get everything that you need out of the one instrument.
So what is, maybe other builders are doing this and I'm not aware of it, but like even just hearing about you filling those what would be empty chambers inside your electric guitar with other woods, do you have prototypes that have like hinges where you can swap out the woods and kind of really dial it in? Or do you just build an instrument, see how it is, try to refine it the next time around if you're not 100% on it?
Well, I'm pretty much building per order. So if I'm talking to a client and I've tried to figure out what it is that he's playing, what genre of music is he playing, what volume does he generally play at, what kind of tonality and what he already owns, then I can pretty much figure out what materials I need to use, what needs to be inside the cavity inside. They're not interchangeable because they're under the top, and once the whole the instrument is assembled, that's a permanent aspect of what's in the instrument, and what that tonal response and what it's going to give the instrument is kind of set in stone at that point. The instruments generally weigh anywhere between 5.25 and 6 pounds.
Wow.
That's pretty light.
Yeah.
So that's part of what any of these instruments are the response of an instrument is a product of that aspect of the weight of the instrument. It's all about energy. And a string vibration is the energy that you're putting into the structure. So it's a matter of physics. If I'm going to pluck an E string, high or low, doesn't matter what string, that's going to represent a certain amount of energy, and the body is going to begin to absorb that energy before it radiates that energy throughout the whole structure. That's where all your points of contact are very important. What is your tailpiece made out of? How light is the tailpiece? How much energy is going to be lost there? Your transfer point where the string is resting on your bridge, are there any moving parts? Why I've eliminated as much of the movement of parts, per se, as you can, so that the string pluck, that energy initially will go through that bridge without any loss of energy and actually go into the body and disperse out from there. If the body is made of material that's heavy, a lot of that energy is going to get absorbed before it actually stimulates the body to vibrate. And how long that vibration is going to last is the same product. Certain amount of energy goes in, how much of it is going to get absorbed, trying to stimulate the body, get it moving, and keep it moving. The heavier the body, the more energy you need. And then you start working your way backwards, because if you've got a body that's heavy, you'll hear a lot of harmonic things that are taking place, but that's all at a volume, acoustically, that's almost negligible in terms of being able to pick it up. And so you won't have something that has a note that blossoms. A note blossoms like if you've are a collector of vintage instruments, the instruments that sing the most are the lightest. The lightest Strat, the lightest Les Pauls, those are the ones that are like kicking. You play it and you say, wow, this thing is just talking to me. It's usually the lightest instrument, so that the instruments, the mass of the instrument, kind of gets out of the way of things. It just cooperates with the vibration you're putting in it, and it just lends itself to sustain, note volume, note presence. All of those things are part of that. So it's a formula, you know, depending upon the player and what he's expecting to get back out of the instrument and what I can perceive as using in terms of material and the inside material. And a lot of people are doing hollow chambers, but a hollow chamber will always have a particular note that it's going to be a sympathetic resonant note that's going to kick that chamber off. And what it'll do is, on one side of that note, that sympathetic resonation, you're going to have a note that's going to blossom and take off. It's going to be a very loud note. On the other side, it's going to eat that note up. It's going to cancel it out. And so if you, instead of using a chamber that's hollow, trying to get a lighter instrument, I place a piece of material into that chamber that's going to resonate and not have that aspect of a hollow chamber that you build standing waves, and I don't care how big the chamber is, it's going to have air pocket trapped in it, and that's going to wreak havoc. It's going to do something on either side of the plus or minus of a note or vibration.
Wow. I mean, you're talking about all of, I mean, just how meticulous you are in terms of building an instrument that is truly acoustic, but then you have to bring electronics into play. You must have some philosophy on pickups.
Well, again, a pickup is only going to do what the instrument does acoustically. So if you can tackle most of what you want out of an instrument in an acoustic value, then the gamut of pickups that you could choose from, be it Duncan, be it, you know, all of the different various, DiMaggio, Lindy Freeland, I have used pickups from the Voodoo pickups, Peter Florence pickups are very good. Nice match set on neck and bridge that are matched really nicely, so that when you have both of them on, you get a really nice, useful sound. I use some of the Gibson pickups, the 57 Classics. They have a neck and a bridge plus pickup, which works out nice. Duncans, there's a variety of Duncans I've used. A lot of clients have preferences that they have come to like that work well in the instruments they have. But again, I tell everybody, placed in another instrument, it's going to have its own voice. And that's pretty much what it is. It's just voicing what the instrument is. And I tell people, my instruments have a certain sound. I insist that people spend time playing an instrument unplugged before we go to plugging it into an amp. So that you get a sense of what the instrument's doing. And then from there, we can figure out what do you want to hear out of the instrument and then really tailor it so that it's not just a hit-and-miss kind of situation.
Got it. Makes perfect sense. You're a busy guy. I don't want to take you away from all your work, and I know you've got some stuff on the home front to do. The one thing that we haven't talked about is you're one of the few black full-time guitar makers in America, if not the only one. Maybe you know of others, do you?
There's one other out on the coast with you. That would be Touch Singleton, and okay. He makes a line of instruments. He makes something that would be more of a production instrument than
okay.
I do.
And there was Willie Carter in the Santa Cruz area for a while, Carter Paulson. I don't know if they're still building or not.
I don't even know who that is.
But why is that? And what is there anything you've been able to do to inspire, or maybe an apprenticeship program? I mean, what was it about you getting into woodworking early that hasn't happened throughout the country?
Well, I think that's a social issue. It is what, as when we're all kids, your parents kind of want to steer you in directions of safety and where they think that you would do best in life. You know, go be a doctor, be a lawyer, be, you know, all of those kind of things. You're pointed in a direction. I was kind of pointed in a direction of following my art aspect of where I was at. And I started off doing a lot of woodworking and stuff, as I said, as a child, and it just continued to morph into other things as I grew up. And when I decided to play music when I was turned on by Jimi Hendrix in college, and I said, okay, I want to be a guitar player. I had a roommate that played bass, and it was really my first formal introduction to instruments and that I actually had in my presence. When I was in high school, I ran track, and there was a band room, but, you know, I knew a bunch of people. And oddly enough, as I got into the business, I realized that I had Nile Rodgers in my school with me playing guitar. I had Eddie Martinez was in my school with me. Luther Vandross was in my school all at the same time. They were down in the basement in the band room while I was running track on the field outside.
Wow.
So I met everybody afterwards, and it was like, oh, my God. a whole nother world that I became aware of after the fact that I was into my world. So, and I still am in touch with all of these people, except for Luther's not here anymore. But why? I think it's just a matter of logistics of the whole aspect of going into a business where you're actually thinking about producing an item, being a manufacturer, and you know, basically setting out on your own journey, on your own road, and deciding this is what I'm going to do and I can be good at it, and be supported at it. And I didn't have anybody else that looked like me. There was no other black folks that I could look at and say, well, I'm doing what, following in the footsteps of. No, I didn't know. There was no footsteps to follow. It's my footprints in the snow, the first snow, you know, so that's the way it went. There's a myriad of reasons why there are no or not enough of us in the field. That's a whole nother, you know, question itself that has to do with the climate of the country, racism, and what opportunities are afforded to you, what doors are closed to you. And I could go on with a whole lot of stories of things that have happened to me in this industry, things that have been said to me that are just off the wall, being the only black man. I've had people launch questions at me and say things to me at shows, and it's like, what the hell? You know, but let it run off your back. I just keep doing what I'm doing.
I hate to ask this because I hate to hear the answer, but do you feel like the industry back when it was ragtag in like 1971 at Guitar Lab was more diverse than it is now?
It wasn't more diverse. I think now there's a lot more on the table that's being challenged in today's world, all the way around.
Yeah.
So issues are more in your face. Things are like being confronted that weren't confronted. Just general, I want to say, stereotypical type of attitudes towards people. You put people in a box, you know, and you never question why. Today, we're questioning everything. We're looking at things that, you know, and saying, well, why? Like you're asking the question now, why? At the time when I was in the business, it wasn't a question anybody asked. I was just there. I'm here. I'm doing what I'm doing.
Sure.
I'm gaining popularity. I'm running the shop. I'm designing instruments. It wasn't until I actually started going to bigger shows, the NAMM show. The first NAMM show I did, was an eye-opener. It were 400 guitar companies. I was the only black guy. I'm the only African-American at the show.
Yeah.
It's like, wow. And I had so many people come to ask me the same question. And then I've had the insulting people come and look at my work and look at the intricacy of what I'm doing and say, where did you get those ideas? Who gave you that?
Jeez.
And I would just say, have you ever seen it before? No. Well, obviously, the buck starts here. And then I've had people tell me that my shapes are not conventional. My arch tops are not conventional. And I didn't study and do my study work under the tutelage of, you know, or lineage of D'Acquisto, D'Angelico, and everything should look like that, and you're avant-garde. Your stuff is just too different to be accepted. I've had people tell me that, and okay, don't want to accept it. And so comes back to me saying, well, I got to keep making this stuff so good, so it sings so well, that it can't be denied. And it may not look like what you think it's supposed to look like, but it sure enough sounds like you would like your stuff to think that it would sound like.
Yeah.
So it's been like, throw the gauntlet down. Okay, I'm here. I'm trying to do just that. Prove you wrong and take a different route, because there is a different route to everything.
I feel like the world of, and maybe you'll correct me on this, but I feel like the world of acoustic guitar makers might be a little more inclusive and community focused than, there seems to be a little more competition with these electric guys. Maybe you'll disagree with me.
No, it's
bad.
Pretty much the same with arch tops and flat tops. And everybody delves into their bracing methods and their carving methods and how thin you can make a top and whether that is important or not, and access in terms of accessibility to the end of the fingerboard, and the list goes on and on, and everyone has their own formula, and so that's pretty much what's at play all the time with electric, acoustic, arch top. It's all a comparative kind of thing where we're all looking at one another. I did a show where most of these shows you're at, invitationals, or even the general shows, by and large, if they allow an amplifier, you're held to a volume. But a lot of these shows, no amplification.
Sure.
So if your instrument doesn't have a great deal of volume, you're struggling to hear what the instrument's doing. And I don't have that issue with my guitars. They are, like I said, my arch top. I don't know which one. I sent you a picture of one. It weighs 4.7 pounds. The thing screams. You can hear it five tables away without an amplifier. So I walk away from my table, and I come back, and I catch the guy who's building next to me with his hand in my sound hole. he's feeling
it's
inside.
A little personal.
And I catch him. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything by that. It's like you're trying to feel how thin the bracing is and where the taper is, that where it comes to the edge of the instrument. You know, there's a lot of proprietary things people have developed over the years in their instrument building. I know I have enough of it, and you kind of want to hide it, and then again, you don't want to hide it. Some simple things like neck block shape and how you address that and the interior of the instrument and what that does to the sound. You can either copy stuff that's already done and not even be aware of what those differences are, and you build along in a kind of a blind way. You just build what's been done. Open a book and get the dimensions of a neck block and a tail block, and that's what you do. Or you can take it to the nth degree, as Ken has done, Parker. We're not satisfied with what's been given in terms of this is the formula. No, that's your formula. I take that formula, take what I need from it to actually accomplish what the job of the tailpiece is, and the job of the neck blank is, and neck block is, and then from there, I want to actually imbue those parts with some other aspect that you have not thought about. You know, how does it contribute to the sound inside the box itself, and what can I do to actually give that the ability to enhance what happens in this acoustic chamber? Which it is. You got to look at the inside of a box of any of the flat top or acoustic or an arch top, like it's a sound room that you're going to record a voice, because the instrument, the bridge position, is going to take that sound from the strings, and that's where it's going to release that into that chamber. Where does it go, and how does it go? Where are standing waves? Where is the sweet spot inside there? All of those questions are part of the answer. The sound, the size of your F-holes, the placement of your F-holes, how much porting is going to happen with the size of the F-hole, and how much actual dynamic pressure is going to be released as you play the instrument. Too much, the instrument loses the ability to actually project. Too little, and the notes never come out. So it's like, and everybody has their idea of how to address this, and at the same token, you want to put your fingerprint on it. You want to do something that's a little different or not. Make an F-hole just like they've been made for a century or more. Or do something that's a statement that is part of your whole design, you know. And that's the direction I go and several people go. You know, so the instrument itself speaks volumes of design work and functionality within that.
I'm glad you mentioned Ken Parker. The whole time I'm thinking you and Ken, I'd love to be a fly on the wall hearing you two look at guitars.
Oh, me and Ken are buddies. Yeah. Me and Ken met on 48th Street and been buddies ever since. Since 78. I just got off the phone with him about an hour ago. So, in fact, Ken has been very instrumental in getting my name mentioned and getting to some of these shows that I'm not on the radar. I am on the radar at this point. So he's been a great help and aid for me throughout the years.
Yeah. Woody, thank you so much. I mean, this is just scratching the surface. We're going to, post-pandemic, when we can have someone come photograph your shop and your guitars, we'll get you in the magazine. But I just wanted to get the ball rolling on this. And
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Woody.
Thank you.